Stripe is the go-to choice for AI companies, from early-stage startups to scaled enterprises. 78% of the leading AI companies use Stripe to go to market quickly and scale globally. That includes pioneers like NVIDIA, OpenAI, and Perplexity. Stripe has developed cutting-edge tools to improve everything from fraud detection to checkout optimization. Whether you're aiming for incremental gains or planning for enterprise transformation, see how Stripe can help at stripe.com.
What's the difference between DIY and doing it yourself? It's the difference between a part-time passion and a full-time business. Wix gives you the power to turn your passion into a moneymaker with a website that fits your unique vision and the business tools you need to succeed. Let your ideas flow with AI that guides you, but keeps you in the driver's seat. Manage your business from one dashboard and keep it growing with built-in marketing features. It's time to turn your daydream into your dream job. Do it yourself. Go to Wix.com.
Taking Stock.
Brought to you by PwC.
This is News Talk.
Welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes-Cullerton, and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. So coming up on today's show, how is Canada's economy set to change course with their new Prime Minister? Why does the world turn to gold in times of economic uncertainty? And this... the theme from The Magnificent Seven there, and later we will be looking at how the seven biggest companies in the world are planning to shape how we work and spend our time. Now, you can send the show an email at takingstock@newstalk.com, or you can message me on social media, whether it's LinkedIn, X or Instagram, at Susan Hayes Cullerton. Now, I'm going to start off this week talking about what an earnings call is, because I find they are such a super business and economic education that comes from a real-time perspective. So if a company is listed on the stock market, it has to go online on a webinar that anybody can access and talk about what has happened in the quarter that has gone by, as well as what they're expecting to happen in the months and years ahead. It generally starts off with the CEO, who gives some really positive outline of everything that has happened, as I say, in the past quarter, etc. Then it's followed by the CFO, the Chief Financial Officer, who will talk about the numbers. And then the really interesting part is after that, when they hold a Q&A session where questions are asked by analysts and then the company has to answer them. Generally, it takes around about an hour for them. And at the moment, we are right in the middle of what we call earnings season. We'll be talking about that later on in the show. But I just wanted to bring it up this week because they are super real-time education, because it gives you a sense of what listed companies are really thinking about, what they're working on, what they're focusing on, and it keeps your finger right on the pulse. Now, he would it with the help of an overbearing neighbour, and I am, of course, referring to Mark Carney's Canadian election victory. I'm delighted to be joined by Robert Fife, Ottawa Bureau Chief of the Globe and Mail newspaper. First of all, Robert, we're delighted to have you on the show. Thanks so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
Okay, so we'll start off by painting a picture, please, Robert. So 70% of Canada's GDP and employment is driven by services. Federal debt is around about 43% of GDP, and your net debt is lowest in the G7. And of course, as we've become well aware, President Trump is urging the country to become the 51st state. So can you paint a picture of Canada today for us in 2025?
Well, this is a country that's very nervous. Over 70% of our exports go to the United States, and we are deeply integrated, more along the lines of north-south than east-west. And the fact that we have a president who wants to impose stiff tariffs on us is going to cause significant economic fallout in this country, jobs and investment, and will likely lead to a recession. And so the country is deeply worried about how we can deal with this. It's not going to be easy to diversify trade immediately, obviously, because everything is going north-south. But obviously the government of Mark Carney wants to look for ways how we can diversify trade, particularly to Asia and to Europe. But also we have to get more of our natural resources to global markets. We have a 800 years supply of natural gas, for example. And we need to get these liquefied natural gas facilities built so we can get a world price. And we need to get our oil also to global markets as well. Right now, our oil goes to the United States at a discount, and then the Americans take it and sell it for world price. These are the issues that the country is grappling with. We also have to tear down interprovincial barriers so that we can trade more fairly and freely across the country. So we have some Mr. Kearney has some major, major issues to confront him with. He is supposed to be meeting the president perhaps next week. It looks like that, to be able to see if we can start negotiations on a new trade and defense cooperation. These are going to be very, very tough negotiations, but we have no choice. We've got to see what we can do.
A really memorable quote from the campaign is that Mark Carney said, "Our old relationship with the United States, a relationship based on steadily increasing integration, is over." Do you believe that's the case?
Yes, it is. It will certainly be over as long as Donald Trump is in the White House. But beyond that, there is obviously a large MAGA electorate and political class that are going to carry on with American First policies that we are just going to have to live with. And so I think he's quite right in the saying that we can't rely on the old relationship where we traded, and we had, you know, we have disputes over softwood lumber or potatoes, for example. But these are sort of, natural kind of disputes that one will have in a large trading relationship. But our economies were so deeply integrated. For example, in the automobile industry, parts go back and forth about 6 or 7 times for one vehicle, just to give you an example. And our border and police and naval and our military are deeply integrated as well. So this is going to be a long process of trying to slowly disengage from the United States. I don't see how we're ever going to go back because the trust has been lost. And I think Europeans are feeling very much the same way.
That's a big statement. It's a really big statement since the trust is lost. Because, of course, it's not just about building back up trade agreements and so on like that. It's also the culture of doing business as well. Can I move away from exports for a moment? Since 30% of the economy is driven by those, that, of course, leads to the fact that an awful lot of the economy is naturally domestic driven, whether it's consumption or whether it's people and businesses and governments investing, etc. What's the sentiment like? You mentioned it being nervous, but what's the consumer sentiment like? Are you seeing a fall off there? Obviously, we've seen that you've decided to perhaps change the location of where people are going on their vacations, etc. Just what's that sentiment like at the moment, Robert?
Well, certainly nobody's going to the United States. Very few people are going to the United States. There's a massive drop in travel to the United States, but it's not just from Canada. Europeans are not going to the United States. Other people are not going to the United States because they don't feel welcome there anymore. And there's billions and billions of dollars of a hit to the U.S. economy as a result of that. So, yes, I think people are reining in a bit of their spending because there's a concern that we might be into a recession. But we haven't reached that point yet. I mean, what's happened so far is that there have been job layoffs in the auto sector, and they say they're not going to be permanent, but we'll wait and see. But it's really one of apprehension right now, because although there have been some job losses, and certainly, and not only in the auto industry, but also in the aluminum and steel industry, because they put in 25% tariffs on us as well for those products. It hasn't had yet at this point a big impact on the economy. We're not in a recession yet, although the United States may be heading into a recession, and we're the little mouse beside the big elephant. And if they go into recession, we will too.
One way that we share a struggle and a challenge, Robert, is that one of the biggest issues facing you is a rising population and a lack of appropriate housing to meet demand is very, very much an issue here in Ireland as well. But in your case, the household debt to income ratio is near 180%, which is among the highest of the advanced economies. How does Mark Carney's policies align with dealing with this? So whether it is housing, whether it is helping people in younger generations to get a house, whether it is the managing the land, etc., how do you see his policies doing something to make a real difference to that?
Well, first of all, the former government of Justin Trudeau mismanaged immigration. We allowed too many people in, and it had a huge effect on the cost of housing and on our healthcare system. And the government is moving to change to allow fewer temporary workers in unless they're absolutely needed in certain types of agricultural jobs. But also, we are going to change. We're going to go back to the way we used to have our immigration system, which is one of the best in the world, is that we would only bring in people who actually had a skill that was needed at a particular time. And in terms of household debt, this has been an ongoing problem for quite a while. It's not just with the last government. It's been going on for a long time that people are spending more than they're making. And the Bank of Canada and other think tanks have been warning about this problem for a considerable period of time. Mr. Carney is moving to remove some of the regulations and take some of the costs out of building of new homes, and he's going to make more land available for housing. This will obviously make a difference, but it can't happen overnight. But we're moving in that he's moving in that direction. His conservative rival in the election campaign had very similar policies in terms of trying to get the housing. More houses built, and I think you're going to see in the budget coming next month or early in June, he's going to basically have a housing czar to see that we can tear down these regulations and try to figure out ways to make more land available for housing.
Indeed, yep. A similar recipe is in place here in Ireland. And one of the things that you have done very well, really admirably, is the way in which you've managed inflation. Of course, when we hear the name Mark Carney, we think of how we've become most familiar with him because he used to be the Bank of England governor. But so you've got somebody who's obviously very experienced in monetary policy, who's now the Prime Minister. How do you feel inflation is now on the ground? The high-level numbers tell us it's now under control in Canada. Is it?
Yeah, it is. But, you know, the problem we've had is that when prices go up, they never come back down, right? So people are still feeling the pinch in terms of groceries, for example. And, we are trying not also to have put on, we've retaliated in some areas by putting tariffs on some American goods, but we're trying not to put tariffs on basic necessities such as groceries and the things that you need to get by every day in life, because they're, which is what, of course, Trump's doing in the United States, which is driving up the cost of living for Americans, including the people who voted for him. Mr. Carney realizes that that's not a particularly smart move. So I think that's another reason why inflation isn't gone up too badly, because we're making sure that any of our retaliatory tariffs are not going to go on, you know, food or other basic necessities that Canadians will need to live their daily lives.
So what I'm hearing is that inflation is under control, but obviously a lot of the price increases are locked into the system, and it's how they're now managed, particularly with the retaliatory tariffs and so on for people on the ground, is what's going to matter. Can I jump back to a point you made about energy? So you mentioned about, you know, the 800 years of natural gas, etc. Is this a point of tension now with Mark Carney? Because as Bank of England governor, he warned of the tragedy of the horizon. He believed in things like carbon pricing and green bonds and climate disclosure to really drive a climate change transition. And yet the energy sector is a cornerstone of the Canadian economy, accounting for about 10 to 12% of GDP. How is he planning to balance that, and how hopeful are you that he will?
Well, he's shown much more practicality and flexibility as when he was running for as prime minister and during the election campaign than he had in the past, where he championed, you know, consumer carbon taxes and all these kind of issues. Look, this country has been really set back for over a decade because the former government of Justin Trudeau were all into climate change, even though we contributed only 1.5% of greenhouse gas emissions to the world. We had tanker bans on the West Coast. We had they killed a Northern Gateway oil project, which would have sent oil to the east, to Asia markets at world price. We killed. They didn't complain or didn't object when another pipeline was going to be built to the U.S. market, and Joe Biden killed it. We had an east-west pipeline that we wanted to build, and they put up so many regulations that the company just said, the hell with it, we're getting out of here. And we have managed to, and Trudeau, the Germans came 2 years ago begging for us to build natural gas facilities on the East Coast so that they could make up for the loss of Russian gas. And Trudeau said basically, no, it's not economically feasible. But we have lots of hydrogen. We'll see you in 50 years' time. And so, of course, the Australians went into the said, "Well, we'll happily sell it to the Germans." So, Mr. Carney is going to, and this, by the way, has caused enormous strains in the federation between the oil producing provinces of Saskatchewan and Alberta. And he is in his election night speech. He talked about, "I'm listening to your concerns. I'll govern. I'm going to govern for all Canadians." He talked about making Canada a super energy power, and so I think he's going to be very open to building more natural gas liquefied natural gas facilities, opening up uranium mines for nuclear power. He understands that if we're going to diversify and get away from the dependence on the American economy, we need to get our natural resources to global markets. We have one pipeline that just been expanded, called the Trans Mountain Pipeline. That pipeline produces 0.5% of the country's GDP. One pipeline. So he's not a fool. He understands that you have to do that, and you can't be locked in this fantasy world of a climate change denier. And frankly, if we sell our natural gas to China and India and other parts of Asia, they won't be burning coal for electricity. And we would actually bring down greenhouse gas emissions and should get credit for it.
There's one thing that underpins everything that you've just said there, and that is the country working together from either a geographical point of view or an energy transmission point of view, etc. And I want to, as we come to the end of this conversation today, I do want to ask you about the interprovincial barriers. So, of course, here in the EU, we have freedom of movement of goods and services. Can you tell us about the trade barriers between regions, and also how people can't move jobs between regions as well, and how you think that might change under this new premiership?
Well, he has promised to bring in legislation that will pass by July 1st that will eliminate any federal impediments to interprovincial trade. But we have a really silly situation where we can't buy British Columbia wine because of barriers, and vice versa. We can't sell Ontario wine into British Columbia. Or the workers in electrician in Saskatchewan can't move to Toronto because he doesn't have you have to get different qualifications. This is all set up to, these are barriers that are set up that make no sense, and they have to come down. It can bring billions and billions of dollars of new wealth to the Canadian economy if we tear down these barriers. Some industries obviously will have to suffer because they're not competitive, and that's the problem with these barriers, right? They create competitive barriers as well, and once you open them up, you will get much more efficiency. And this happened in when we did the Canada-U.S. Free Trade Agreement with the United States. We opened up whole areas of markets. Some businesses failed, but overall, we created more wealth and more millions of jobs because of that.
It really has been fascinating to talk to you and to give us a really interesting insight into the economic and the political and the social environment on the ground in Canada during the really momentous week there. Robert Fyfe, Ottawa Bureau Chief of the Globe and Mail, thank you so much indeed for joining me today.
You're welcome. Bye.
This is Susan Hayes-Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, where are the Magnificent Seven now?
Stripe is the go-to choice for AI companies, from early-stage startups to scaled enterprises. 78% of the leading AI companies use Stripe to go to market quickly and scale globally. That includes pioneers like NVIDIA, OpenAI, and Perplexity. Stripe has developed cutting-edge tools to improve everything from fraud detection to checkout optimization. Whether you're aiming for incremental gains or planning for enterprise transformation, see how Stripe can help at stripe.com.
Running a business can be exhausting. Building your website shouldn't be. With Wix, you can express your ideas, give direction, then leave the heavy lifting to AI, from site creation to branded content and images. Have fun with the details. Customize what you want, the way you want, and manage your whole business from a centralized dashboard with expert AI tools. Build, scale, and enjoy the incredible results. You can do it all yourself on Wix.
The Slayer has been activated.
All the power of hell cowering before one man.
Id Software presents Doom the Dark Ages. Pre-order now.
Rated mature.
The wrongs we must right. The fights we must win. The future we must secure together for our nation. This is what's in front of us. This determines what's next for all of us. We are Marines. We were made for this.
Welcome back to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes-Cullerton. The US stock market has been driven by the health or otherwise of the Magnificent Seven, and they are Apple, Microsoft, Alphabet, Amazon, Nvidia, Meta, and Tesla. And by the way, Alphabet is the parent of Google. Now, the reason for this is that we're spending more of our time or our money on these companies' products and services. And as we're now settling right into earnings season, where companies issue their financial reports, we want to ask, how are these companies doing? And what can we learn about the economy and consumer trends as a result? So I'm delighted to be joined by Russ Mould, Investment Manager at AJ Bell. Hello, Russ.
Hello, Susan.
Russ, I'm going to start off by and with a piece of accepted wisdom, which is to diversify your portfolio. However, you might think you're doing that like when you buy an S&P 500 fund, which is a fund tracking the largest 500 companies in the US. But Reuters quotes that the Magnificent Seven was responsible for well over half of the S&P 500's 58% return in 2023 and 2024. And of course, the size of these companies has really grown then in that S&P 500 fund. So can I ask you, are passive investors or people who simply want to diversify their portfolio easily with these types of funds, are they facing massive concentration risk now?
There's certainly an element of risk there because these seven companies represent roughly a third of the S&P 500's total stock market valuation and therefore roughly a fifth of global stock market valuation. So you might not be quite as diversified as perhaps you think you are. I mean, you might not be too worried because these companies have been fantastic performers. I guess the risk that you've got is that there have been similar times before when the market's been similarly concentrated. Go-go technology companies in the late 1960s, Nifty 50 in America in the mid-1970s, tech stocks in the late 1990s, and they all worked for a long time until they didn't. And it's a little bit like sitting on a boat where everybody's gone to one side. At some stage, either everybody has to move back to the middle or the other side, or the boat tips over. But the question is when, and the honest truth to that is nobody knows.
Isn't it hard to imagine that there is seven companies worth a fifth of the global stock market, Russ?
It's not something I've been used to very often. I mean, even in the technology stocks of the late 1990s, things weren't that imbalanced. But you could say the big difference between now and the 1990s is these seven companies are generally extremely profitable. You can argue that Tesla's profits have come under the hammer right now, but the other six are wildly profitable, and that wasn't necessarily the case with the dot-com companies in the late 1990s, some of which were not much more than a twinkle in a milkman's eye when it came to profits.
I don't know how many twinkles are in milkman's eyes when it comes to profits, but you brought up Tesla, and I'd like to start with that one, because chronologically, Tesla was the first one of the seven to have the earnings out. So as I was on that call, there was a lot of conversation and very few numbers, but revenue was down, earnings or profits were down, the stock price was down. And two numbers stood out for me. Not that I heard in the earnings call, but I went and as I researched around the guidance that was given at the time. One is that the margin fell by 133 basis points. In other words, Tesla is now making less money or less profit out of every $100 that they're selling. And the other one was the earnings per share, or just that profit number in general, fell by 71%. Now, they're really important numbers, in my opinion, because if it's making less money as it generates money, and secondly, if the profits in general are down by that level, obviously the stock market responded. It wasn't very, very happy with that, and the share price fell. But what did you take out of that Tesla earnings call?
The numbers stank. And that wasn't the first time either. Now, the company kind of talked its way around it. You know, Mr. Musk was on the call and he said, well, look, you know, a lot of that is down to the retooling of the facilities because of the Model Y, the new Model Y. We'll get that back on track. And also, don't forget, we've got lots of other things coming up the pipe, like the Cybertruck, like autonomous driving, like robots. So again, he talked a really, really good story. But the numbers themselves, Tesla itself, the core car business, just looked like a mortal car company where there's fierce competition and margin pressure. And you've talked about stock market valuations. Tesla's got a stock market value of around $900 billion, and it's making about, what, $6 billion a year? So that's a pretty punchy multiple. It's going to need to start showing some rapid profits growth quickly, or that valuation's going to start looking, you know, really pretty stretched.
Oh, well, it's probably already quite stretched, and actually a lot less stretched, though, than it was at an earlier stage in the year, because it really has lost a lot of ground since the beginning of the year. But another thing that stood out to me about that earnings call is how they said such emphasis, or they put such emphasis on the battery storage business. Is that a shining light, we'll say, among the horizon there in Tesla?
It's potentially an extremely strong story. And again, this is where Tesla fans will push back on statements like the first quarter numbers stank, because they will look at the long-term potential of all of the different businesses that are in there. Skeptics will point to the fact that that car business is coming under extreme duress. Some of the businesses, profits that it generates from selling carbon credits to European car makers now going to come under pressure because they've been given more breathing space in terms of their targets for 2030 by the European Union. So there are a lot of moving parts there, but they're not all necessarily moving in the right direction.
And Mr. Musk says he's moving back towards the company and spending less time on Doge. And of course, we saw this week then that the company was talking about how they're not looking for a replacement CEO, etc. How much do you think that the Tesla price and the reaction to it is based on Elon Musk's interaction with it and less about the fundamentals of the business?
Well, he's clearly seen as a very, very strong positive for the business by supporters of the stock. Equally, skeptics of the stock probably don't particularly care for him, think he's spread himself a little bit too thinly. And there will be people out there who'll view him as a liability because of the political association with the Trump presidency, which some people have held up as a reason why European and Californian Tesla sales have dropped through the floor.
Well, let's move from Tesla to Google, which was the next one out after that. Now, total contrast to what we've just been talking about, revenue was up by 12%. Earnings per share increased 49%. And it was a really interesting earnings call. A lot of new developments in there. But one that stood out to me is that one might think, isn't everybody on ChatGPT? Who's Googling anymore? But what came up that during that call is that now AI overviews, which is when you Google something, but an AI gives you the answer to your question rather than directs you to a link, has had over 1.5 billion users per month. And so therefore, Russ, do you think Google can restore its dominance with AI overview? They mentioned Gemini 2.5, etc.
I mean, so that's what it's looking to do. I mean, Gemini, it's in your face all the time when you're logging on now. That AI offering is you've got, it kind of pops up straight away if you log on to Google Chrome or any of search. And Google's dominance in search is clearly what it's going to need to defend from these alternatives. It's still got YouTube, which is still doing its business, and it's still driving an awful lot of advertising revenue. And there are other things in there as well, like autos and some of the moonshot business. But the core is search. They need to defend that. And again, this is the thing for any of these companies, any of these big seven, they look almost indomitable right now, possibly with the exception of Tesla. But over the long term, any company's business model is challenged by three things: competition / obsolescence, the customer dissatisfaction, and if that doesn't get you, then the regulator might come after you for making too much money. And all of these companies face all of these challenges to various degrees. At the moment, they're weathering them better than most, but it doesn't mean that they're infallible forever. And you're right, AI and ChatGPT will be one of the barbarians that's knocking at the gate of some of these business models.
So how do you take on those three things? Competition, customer dissatisfaction, or the regulator is investment. And one of the figures that jumped right out at me, and it was similar in some of the other ones as well, is just the sheer amount of money that they're planning to invest. So Google says they are planning to invest $75 billion in CapEx, which is up from $55 billion last year. I mean, you know, these are really, really big numbers that they're investing. And a lot of these are into parts of the business which either show uncertain projectiles or they're obviously subject to a lot of moving parts, etc. I mean, what do you find are the big companies really placing their big bets on?
I mean, at the moment, a lot of it is, as you say, is AI. At the moment, the only company that's really making any money out of this is NVIDIA, which we might come on to shortly with its silicon chips, which are driving the servers that provide the cloud storage that homes the large language models that drives AI and hopefully in the future generative AI. But with a lot of the others, it's, you know, a lot of investment in data centers, research and development, technology, scraping the internet for all the data, agglomerating that data, turning it into something that people can use. The economics of that, yeah, we're waiting to see how much people are prepared to pay for it and over what time period. So there are still some big question marks there. It's why some of these company share prices came under pressure late last year, turn of this year. In that, are they actually going to get a return on this investment? And we're only going to find out over time. For last year, the companies were rewarded for spending. But we've seen that before. We saw it with technology in the late 1990s. We saw it with shale oil in the mid-2010s. They both turned into big investment busts when it turned out that people had overdone it. Clearly, that's not the expectation right now. And that's why these shares trade on the high valuations that they do. But if anything like that does go wrong, then we might see some dramatic share price reversals.
One of the things that has commanded a high valuation all along has been where people are spending their time, giving their attention without necessarily giving their money. And in the Google earnings call, they mentioned that YouTube celebrated its 20th birthday. They now have 20 billion videos on YouTube and they get 20 million videos uploaded every day. But if we wanted to talk about a company that knows how to get attention, if we now shift to Meta, who also had their earnings out this week, just for anybody who's listening and isn't familiar with the company, they own Facebook, Instagram and WhatsApp. And Mark Zuckerberg pointed out that they're focusing on 5 major opportunities now, including improved advertising, more engaging experiences, business messaging, Meta AI and AI devices. What did you take out of what he had to say this week?
I mean, again, the vast majority of Meta's revenues come from advertising. So it is all about eyeballs and customer engagement. And that's why they've got Instagram. It's why they've got WhatsApp. It's why they've got Facebook and why they're looking to develop those services as best they possibly can. Clearly, you've got, you know, regulators again looking at that. Should they be allowed to own all of these companies is one of the questions that's been put out. It's out there right now with the US Federal Trade Commission. So, again, that pressure is not going away. But so far, with Facebook users, with daily average and monthly average users going up, Meta is doing the job that investors want to see, which is engaging with people, keeping them engaged, engaging with more people and providing them with more services.
Well, speaking of engaging with people, how about now we turn to Microsoft, who was the next one up, a sparkling performance in their earnings call. And I found that hour-long session really was like a window into the future of work. But are we going to be talking to people or are we going to be talking to bots? Because more than, and this is a quote from the transcript of it, more than 230,000 organizations, including 90% of the Fortune 500, have already used Copilot Studio. And this is a tool where you can build your own bot for your company using low or no code. I mean, is this the future of customer service, of, you know, customer wikis, of how people are onboarded in companies? Is this where it's at, Russ?
I think it'll depend upon the business. I'm always quite in favour of talking to a person if I definitely can, but then I'm 55 and I guess that's just the way I was brought up. But I'm sure that more and more companies will be looking to provide efficiencies and what they would view as top quality service through this sort of mechanism because it's cheaper for them and they'll argue it will provide the customer with what they want as quickly as they need it. So that is very much what Microsoft has got. And if you look at what Microsoft has done, a lot of people still think of it in terms of being Windows and operating systems for laptops. That's still a really big part of the company's cash flow. But a lot of the growth is from Azure, which is, again, the cloud business. It's for large language models and AI. It's from gaming. And it's from this fantastic suite of business products, which do act as formidable productivity tools for an awful lot of companies.
Of course, I have to ask you about the geopolitical environment as well. I mean, if we take two more of the Magnificent Seven in the past while, we've seen Apple is planning to move some of its manufacturing to India from China. We saw Amazon attracting the ire of the president in the US this week when there was a suggestion they may show the add-on price of any tariff. What do you think is coming down the tracks in terms of the geopolitical environment and what we could be hearing in the next quarter's earnings calls of these companies?
If I knew what President Trump was thinking, Susan, I absolutely promise I would tell you that I'm not sure necessarily from day to day that he's entirely sure himself. So I think in that respect, you know, running any company is going to be difficult. Running a lot of these companies will be even more difficult because they're right, that some of their businesses are right in the firing line, or equally they were, given that Trump has now rolled out some exemptions for some of these businesses, particularly Apple and semiconductor silicon chips, for example. So in some ways, they're right at the forefront, but equally they're big, powerful firms. They're good people to have on side because of the reach they have, the technology they provide. And so there's probably a little bit of a dance to be done between the two, I should think.
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned NVIDIA because we have run out of time and that was going to be the last one that I was going to ask you about. And I know their earnings are out on the 28th of May, so we'll have to have another conversation then. But that has been really super to hear a rapid fire round across all of the seven of the Magnificent Seven. Russ Mould, Investment Manager at AJ Bell, thanks so much for joining me.
My pleasure. Keep well.
This is Susan Hayes-Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, hear why the world turns to gold in a crisis.
Stripe is the go-to choice for AI companies, from early-stage startups to scaled enterprises. 78% of the leading AI companies use Stripe to go to market quickly and scale globally. That includes pioneers like NVIDIA, OpenAI, and Perplexity. Stripe has developed cutting-edge tools to improve everything from fraud detection to checkout optimization. Whether you're aiming for incremental gains or planning for enterprise transformation, see how Stripe can help at stripe.com.
Running a business is hard work. Building your website shouldn't be. With Wix, you can express your ideas, give direction, then leave the heavy lifting to AI, from site creation to branded content and images. Have fun with the details. Customize what you want the way you want. And manage your whole business from a centralized dashboard with expert AI tools. Build, scale, and enjoy the incredible results. You can do it all yourself on Wix.
The Slayer has been activated.
Id Software presents Doom: The Dark Ages. Pre-order now.
Rated mature.
The wrongs we must right. The fights we must win. The future we must secure together for our nation. This is what's in front of us. This determines what's next for all of us. We are Marines. We were made for this.
You're welcome to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes-Cullerton, and now we'll be delving into the enduring appeal and stability of gold, a commodity that has held its value across centuries, political upheavals and economic cycles. And as markets fluctuate, currencies rise and fall, gold continues to be seen as a safe haven for investors and nations alike. But why has gold maintained its status as a store of value, and why does it continue to play such a vital role in global finance? So we're joined now by Nigel Doolin of Core Bullion Traders. Nigel, you're very welcome.
Thank you for having us.
And I'm going to start off with a report that was issued this week from the World Gold Council to say that total demand for gold is up by 1%. Jewellery fabrication is down. Technology demand is down. Central banks brought 244 tons of gold in Q1, which is a slowdown from the previous quarter. But global investment demand for gold has rocketed. And particularly demand for gold bars and coins, as well as investment in ETFs, rose 170% over the same time period last year. Can you tell us why is the case?
I think the gold market in general has opened up to more people, right? I mean, it's very easy for people to get information on buying gold now and researching gold. And that's really because of the boom in the retail investor, as it's been termed, you know, which crypto has a little bit to do with. But I think it's just people's ease of access to information. It's interesting there, that point that, the demand for gold has risen where jewellery has dropped off, because jewellery historically is one of the biggest sort of uses of gold. You know, it's generally 50% of the world's gold goes into jewellery. So with that dropping off and the demand going up, just shows you that it's all investment.
Well, it is, because particularly the demand for gold from a jewellery point of view is, of course, consumption driven. So if people are lowering their faith in that. But I do want to put one challenge to you, and that is that people often say, like, gold is a reliable source of wealth. It consistently maintains its value. But gold is up 90% since COVID.
Yeah.
Like, is it overvalued?
It could very well be, but then, I mean, you know, where does it stop and where does that go? And I think you've got, with so many governments and central banks around the world buying more and more gold, you know, I look at that and I go, well, these men and women are a lot more intelligent than I am. They're not doing that for no reason, right? So it's how much can they push it? How much can they put into it? And why are they doing that? And that's the real question about where it'll go to, you know?
So when people do come to you, why are they putting their money into gold? Is it for that consistency or that reliable store of wealth? Is it for upside?
It's generally for safety and security. Yeah, I mean, it should be seen as a store of wealth more than, you know, you're not going to make, there's easier ways to make a lot of money quicker than with gold, right? Now, people have done that over the last few years because of how much it has increased. But it's, people are coming to us because they want a bit of safety. They're a bit worried about banks. They're a bit worried about having cash, inflation eating away at their buying power. So they're putting it into gold and you know, hoping that it'll maintain at least their buying power in 4 or 5 years' time or whatever.
So maintain their buying power. So they're trying to keep up with inflation as distinct to put money into an investment that won't lose its value.
Yeah, bit of both. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, it's you know, if somebody has, one of the clients said to me recently, he said, you know, well, I've got 50,000 sitting in the bank and, you know, the buying power of that is going to be less next year, with no matter how much or little inflation is. So I put it into gold. It should do better, you know, and he'd be able to cash in then at the end of the 2 years, 3 years, and have, if not the same, more buying power.
You mentioned cryptocurrency. Now, yeah. That to me seems to be the antithesis of gold. I mean, cryptocurrency, first of all, I can't hold it.
Yeah.
Secondly, it's backed by a digital asset as opposed to anything that I can cash in at a central bank. It's immensely more volatile than gold is. Yeah. So why do you think that there's a linkage between cryptocurrency and gold now? Where do you see that coming from?
I don't know if I might have said that the wrong way. I don't think there is a link between crypto and gold. I think it's between the people who buy crypto or who look into buying crypto, and they're now looking into buying alternatives. If they're into crypto, they're into alternatives, okay? I mean, me personally, I think you may as well go to a bookies and put your money on a horse as buy crypto. I don't believe in it either. But people who are interested in that are interested in other forms of investment and slightly alternative forms of investment, and that's why they look into gold. And I think that's why gold has had a bit of an uptick in the whole crypto boom, you know.
Can I ask you as well about your customer who you said there came in with the 50 grand sitting in the account, with a view to maintaining the real value of his purchasing power? Does gold really act as an inflation hedge? Does it preserve the value of one's money relative to prices?
I think historically it has. You know, I mean, and that's all you have to do is look back on the price of it historically, and that's what it's done. It's beaten inflation time after time, you know.
Right. Let's say somebody is listening today and they want to consider this, right? Mm. They want to consider buying gold. When I think about ways in which I could buy it, I could actually buy a gold bar or buy a gold coin. Anytime I've bought gold in the past, I've bought it through an exchange traded fund. Mm-hmm. And just for listeners who may not be familiar with that is, it's basically a fund that tracks the price of something rather than buying the physical currency, and you can liquidate it anytime. Another thing you could do is you could buy the shares of a gold miner, or else you could buy a digital asset tracking the price of gold that isn't a fund. What is could you walk us through each of the four of them and the advantages and disadvantages of them?
Yeah, I mean, okay, so you've got gold coins, you've mm-hmm. got gold bullion bars, okay? Well, any bars are considered bullion. So gold coins, I always think, I would never really advise that you buy that. If you're doing it purely for financial purposes, some people are buying to start nice collections, to leave nice gifts to their children or grandchildren or whatever. Coins might be the way to go. Coins will be more expensive than bars, than bullion, because, you know, a 1 ounce coin, there's minting charge on that. Some are more in demand than others due to collectors. So they will cost you more to buy. But if you sell back to a bullion company like ourselves or anybody else, you won't make that difference back because we all pay based on the weight. So you've got the bars and the coins. If it's purely for investment purposes or financial reasons you're doing it, I would advise the bars. You've got your certificate format then. You know, you can do it in certificate. Knocks out third-party counter risk. It knocks out any security or storage issues you have. It's generally a lower premium if you do it in certificate format because, you know, you don't have shipping costs, you don't have insurance costs to get the gold to wherever you bought it from for you to collect. The other ones?
ETFs,
okay. Mm-hmm. Sorry, exchange-traded funds, yeah. I mean, look, I think that's, in the gold industry, there's a little bit of a backlash against ETFs because they haven't, it hasn't been audited for quite a while. So, you know, it's considered that it's oversold. ETFs are oversold. So, you know, no big deal unless everybody calls it in. If everybody calls it in, then there's going to be trouble.
And then to buy the shares of companies who are mining gold, what's your take on that? Like, that is a way in which to get exposure to the asset class, one might say,
yeah.
Or is it?
Yeah, it absolutely is. I mean, look what Buffett did. A man who's famously anti-gold.
Very famously.
And he put $500 million into Barrick Gold, a mining company there last year, you know. So obviously believes in the demand for gold. So yeah, I think that a lot more research is involved in that. I mean, there are a lot of gold mining companies out there. There are a lot who go out consistently looking for finance. So yes, it's definitely a way to get in there and have some interest in the market, you know.
Can we move to central banks then? You mentioned obviously Warren Buffett there, who is somebody who is now, he as you say, famously he's said, what's the point in digging something out of the ground to then put it in a vault and leave it alone and it doesn't give a dividend? Another myth that we need to deal with. But central banks have become net buyers of gold, particularly over the past 10 or 15 years, and they now account for a fifth of all the gold that has been mined throughout history. Why is it that central banks are buying gold? Because I'm sure they're doing so differently than your person with your 50 grand. So why are they doing that? And is it likely to be sustained? This is going to matter to the retail investor, because if they start walking away from this market, of course, it would push the price down as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's security. I mean, that's what it is. And it's how far can they push it? How far can the price go up, and how much more value can they get out of it? And that's the reason they buy it, as far as I can see.
One other thing we need to talk about that's different to the price is the volatility. And depending on the time frame you look at, State Street tells us that gold is as volatile as equities, but it's less volatile than other real assets. And Morgan Stanley says that volatility in silver prices can be 2 to 3 times greater than that of gold in a given day. So what's your experience of both the volatility of gold, but also your customers' reactions to when they want to buy or sell?
Yeah. I don't see it as being hugely volatile asset class, right? The dips tend to be, it's a commodity, it will dip. And I say this to everybody who comes in, I'm like, you know, it will always dip. But they tend to be less than the jumps when it comes to gold. And if you look at the price over the last 17, 18 years, consistently, it's just gone one way with the dips in between, okay? So what we always say to people is, look, buy it with a view to holding it over a mid to medium to long term. If you can hold on to it during those dips, if you don't need to sell during those dips, ride them out, well, then you're going to be okay at the end of the day, you know? But I just don't see it as being that volatile. It's not that volatile as far as I'm concerned, you know? It's just, the dips are smaller than the rises, and that's just fact.
Silver is certainly known as gold's more volatile cousin, all right. Is that an area that you find that there is a demand for, maybe for people who can't afford the larger price of gold, or is that something that you and your company deal with?
We don't deal with physical silver. We sell silver in certificate format, and purely because there's no VAT in that instance. There's VAT if you buy physical silver in this country, any white metal in this country, you're paying VAT on it. So I just don't see that as something that's worthwhile. And, you know, you buy it to invest in it and you're 23% down it straight away. It doesn't make much sense to me. So we sell that through certificate format, which means you don't collect it physically and therefore you don't pay VAT. And that's the only way to buy silver, as far as I'm concerned, would be to do it that way without the VAT.
Unless a business is buying it and they can redeem it.
Of course, absolutely, yeah. If they can get it back. And the premiums tend to be a lot bigger on silver as well, you know, because of the price point. Like, your premiums would be maybe 15 to 25% to buy and 10 to sell. So your spread is coming up to around 40%, whereas with gold, your maximum spread would be 5 to 7%, you know?
So looking ahead, I mean, you know, as we have looked at the price of gold over the past, this year to date, every week it is, now it's hitting a new high and now it's hitting a new high. What's your take on what the headlines will be over the coming months? Not, of course, expecting that you have a crystal ball here to bring in with us today, but what generally is your take on the outlook of where this is going?
I think, look, we have 4 years of uncertainty ahead of us with the White House. So, and uncertainty, unfortunately, is good for gold and the price of gold. And I just think that's the way. Like, I can't see it going and continuing in an upward trajectory forever. You know, nothing does that. But I can certainly see over the next 2 to 3 years a consistent rise.
Well, thank you very much indeed for taking us through both the past, the present and the future of the asset class indeed. Thank you very much indeed. Nigel Doolan of Core Bullion Traders.
Thank you very much.
And so that's it for Taking Stock this week with me, Susan Hayes-Cullerton. I hope you enjoyed the show and hopefully that you learned something about economics and how it affects our world. And I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast, first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app or wherever you go to get your podcasts. And please do add us to wherever you go to get those podcasts. It's also on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer of Taking Stock is John Fardy, and on research this week was Simon Keane and Stephen Daunt. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thanks so much for listening and enjoy the rest of your day and indeed your bank holiday Monday. And I look forward to chatting to you next week.
Got an amazing business idea, but haven't locked in a domain name? Search Wix Domains and claim yours before someone else snags it. Your ideal.com, .net, .u is out there. Search Wix Domains and set your brand in motion.